So it is the bewitching hour. Dan and Shelley, welcome. Thank you for being with me. It's a pleasure always to be chatting with you. Maybe by just a little introductory, I would like to say to everyone on the line that obviously there seems to be a fair amount of interest in this subject, probiotics. The registrations have been fast and furious for this workshop, and it's really quite wonderful to be on the line tonight with Shelley and Dan talking about both celiac disease and IBS, which is where we've got most of our participants and respondents. We've certainly had a lot of support from some wonderful bloggers in the community, as well as the NFCA as a joint partner in this workshop. And one of the reasons for doing it is that there is a lot of interest in probiotics. And in fact, today, I know, Shelley, you and I were both online listening. There was an all-day workshop on the subject, so it seems to be quite timely that this has come up for everyone. So what I had mentioned is that the format of the workshop has certainly been around the types of questions we received. Also, though, it's very important to say that the content of what we're presenting is never to give someone a diagnosis, and obviously we do refer you to your own health professionals, but it's to give you some new information and updates and different kinds of perspectives on what's been happening in the industry. So, by way of introduction, Dan, it's a pleasure always to have you. And certainly you are a preeminent nutrition expert, a gastroenterologist, and in particular you've had a focus on a celiac disease. Now you are the Director of Clinical Research and also a founding member of the Celiac Center at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, Massachusetts. You obviously see patients, you conduct research, and you are on the faculty at the Harvard Medical School. You have published numerous articles, chapters, and you do speak internationally on this subject. It's wonderful to have your book as a reference, Real Life with Celiac Disease, and I certainly was reviewing it again, and I think the cases and the way that you formatted the book is terrific, and you do spend quite a bit of time as well talking about IBS in this book. It's not dedicated only to celiac disease, and I know you're going to outline some of the relationships there. As well, you have a terrific chapter on probiotics and the relationship they have to these disease conditions, so we're looking forward to hearing all about that. And then Shelley, once again, Shelley and I is a great friend and someone I've had the honor of working with a number of times. She is a registered dietitian, a leading international nutrition expert on celiac disease and the gluten-free diet. She is a member of the medical advisory boards of the Celiac Disease Foundation and the Gluten Intolerance Group in the United States, and the professional advisory board of the Canadian Celiac Association. Many of you might have seen Shelley. She's been on several television and radio programs like the NBC Today Show and CBC News World. She is a very popular speaker and I've certainly had many a workshop that I've attended that she's spoken at. She is also the author of The Gluten-Free Diet, a comprehensive resource guide. And again, one of those books I keep on my shelf when I have to look things up. And certainly any nutrition information, resources, manufacturers of gluten-free products, she's the expert. It's in its fourth edition, and it's definitely highly recommended by health professionals and consumers, a very consumer-friendly book. So Dan and Shelley, thank you. It's a privilege to have you both here. So those of you listening, again, get out your pencils and paper. If you have any notes you want to take, we will send out transcripts, and we will send out an audio version of this. They will also be posted on the jamesondirect.com/probiotic website. And I'm Tricia Ryan, and I want to welcome everyone here. So, Dan, as a gastroenterologist, can you give us a quick refresher about gut health and the three conditions we're discussing tonight, celiac disease, gluten sensitivity, and IBS? How common are they, and what are the typical symptoms?
Sure, and that's a really important place to start, and it gives us a nice framework for going forward. So, you know, all of these conditions, first of all, are very common. I'll start with celiac disease a little bit. This is thought to affect between 1 and 2% of the general population, and that makes it quite common. And just as a frame of reference, that's about twice as prevalent as type 1 diabetes or as all of inflammatory bowel disease. So it's a very prevalent condition. It is a systemic autoimmune inflammatory disease that's triggered by the toxic proteins found for these patients, toxic at least, in wheat, rye, barley, and a few other related grains. It's characterized by damage to the small intestine, enteropathy, and by generation of autoantibodies that can attack virtually any part of your body. It is a lifelong condition that can arise at any age. Moving on to the other side of the spectrum is irritable bowel syndrome. This is probably the most common gastrointestinal disorder and affects around 20% of the general population. The reason people get irritable bowel syndrome in opposition to celiac disease is really unknown. We don't know why people get irritable syndrome and in general what triggers it. It is not characterized by inflammation in the way that celiac disease is, but the symptoms that it can cause can overlap significantly. And it really is a syndrome where people have gastrointestinal symptoms that exist after exclusion of conditions like celiac disease. Now, gluten sensitivity sort of is somewhere in the middle. It is a condition where people people respond to withdrawal of gluten from the diet, i.e. they feel better when they're on a gluten-free or very low-gluten diet, but yet they don't have the inflammation, the damage to the small intestine, and in most cases the antibody production that you see in celiac disease. And this, out of the three, is really the least known of the conditions and the least well-studied. It's really unclear at this point how common gluten sensitivity is, although there are some suggestions that it makes up a significant portion of the irritable bowel syndrome population. And even if it made up, say, 5 to 10% of irritable bowel syndrome patients, it would actually be more common than celiac disease itself. So that's really a space that we're really just beginning to explore. It's a very exciting part of the gluten-related disorders study.
Well, that's long-winded, but got me covered there. Now, testing or diagnosing, because since they are, there's you can probably make some mistakes, not you personally, but where someone might have one or the other. I know you refer to that in your book. So what are the typical testing procedures with the three conditions?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And actually anyone, myself included, can mistake patients in the beginning for what they have and have not, because, again, you can damage the intestinal tract or you can do this and that, but it can really only tell you in so many ways. There's only so many gastrointestinal symptoms out there. You can have abdominal pain, you can have diarrhea, you can have indigestion, dyspepsia, but there's a short list, and so all of these GI diseases, whether you're talking about inflammatory bowel disease or celiac disease or irritable bowel syndrome, can have a lot of very much overlapping symptoms. And so really the goal is to find anything that you find, basically rule out the things that need very specific treatments, i.e. celiac disease in this test. So really, we are getting to the point now that we're really suggesting celiac disease testing, which is simple serologic testing, usually for IgA tissue transglutaminase, or TTG, in anyone who has chronic gastrointestinal symptoms that are not otherwise explained. If those are positive, then you go on to do endoscopies and anything else you need to confirm celiac disease. If those are negative, however, you can, in general, in most cases, proceed with the confidence that this is not celiac disease, and it's either irritable bowel syndrome with or without a component of gluten sensitivity to it. And once a patient has irritable bowel syndrome, there's a number of things that we'll be talking about, I think, throughout the hour that you can do to treat that. But one of those is certainly to assess for food sensitivities, of which gluten sensitivity is probably one of the most common.
So those two often are linked then?
Yes, quite.
So then, Shelley, from your perspective as the dietitian, are there dietary strategies that are used for the treatment of celiac disease, gluten sensitivity, and IBS, and how do you differentiate those?
Well, for those people that have a clinical diagnosis of celiac disease or even non-celiac gluten sensitivity, the treatment is still the same. It is a strict gluten-free diet. What we don't know is for those people that have gluten sensitivity, whether it's a lifelong gluten sensitivity and whether they need to follow it as strictly as someone with celiac disease. But for our purposes today, let's assume that it is both the same and that gluten, as Dan mentioned, is the protein found in the grains, wheat, rye, and barley. So they need to follow a gluten-free diet, which means eliminating wheat, including durum, spelt, kamut, einkorn, emmer, farro, couscous, barley malt flavoring and extract, malt vinegar, brewer's yeast, beer, ale, and lager, and oats, unless they are pure, uncontaminated, specialty gluten-free oats. So with that long list, this diet certainly can be very challenging because there's so many foods and ingredients that are derived from gluten. But the good news is that there are a wide variety of naturally gluten-free options ranging from plain meat, poultry, fish, seafood, eggs, nuts, seeds, legumes, fruits and vegetables, milk, yogurt, and cheese, as well as a lot of gluten-free grains, seeds, and flours that come from amaranth, arrowroot, buckwheat, corn, flax, millet, legumes and nuts, potato, quinoa, rice, sorghum, soy, tapioca, teff, and wild rice. And we know now that there's many stores carrying a really good selection of gluten-free specialty products, ranging from breads and buns and bagels and muffins, cakes and cookies and pizza, baking mixes and hot and cold cereals, crackers, pastas, entrees, soups, sauces, snack bars, and snack foods. So you can even get gluten-free beer. And distilled alcohols like rye, rum, gin, and vodka, plus wine and liqueurs can also be enjoyed on a gluten-free diet. So it is a challenging diet, and that's why I really encourage people to work with a registered dietitian with expertise in the gluten-free diet and celiac disease and gluten sensitivity. Now, for people with IBS, because the cause of IBS is unknown and it's multifactorial, the dietary strategies really need to be individualized. Foods that may cause some problems vary from person to person, but there are some foods that may make IBS worse. And this is why you need to work, again, with a registered dietitian who can help you determine what those foods and beverages that may need to be avoided and what things you can eat, and make sure you're getting a healthy, adequate, nutritious diet. But there's a few good tips and places to start. One is certainly by eating a well-balanced diet and eating regular meals and drinking plenty of fluids, as well as eliminating or reducing caffeine, cutting back on sugars and processed foods, avoiding some of the gassy vegetables, decreasing your fat intake, and avoiding carbonated beverages can also be helpful. But it really depends on whether you have diarrhea-predominant IBS or constipation-predominant, or you alternate between constipation and diarrhea. That'll have an impact on the strategies that you're going to take. And the types of fibers consumed will also affect people differently. Soluble fiber, for example, dissolves in water and forms a gel in our guts, which slow down the digestion, and it's often better tolerated. Whereas insoluble fiber that's found in whole wheat and wheat bran and various fruits and vegetables has a laxative effect. And this type of fiber is not always well tolerated, so it can cause more bloating and gas for many people with IBS. And for those with constipation-predominant IBS, a high-fiber diet can help. And what I think is really interesting, there's very new emerging research coming out of Australia from dietitian Sue Shepherd and Dr. Gibson with the FODMAP diet that may help up to 75% of people with IBS. Now, FODMAP, spelled F-O-D-M-A-P-S, they're a family of sugars and fibers that can produce bloating, pain, gas, and diarrhea in certain individuals, including those with IBS or celiac disease. And FODMAP is an acronym for, here's a mouthful for you, fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. And that's quite the words, but in English that translates to lactose, which is the naturally occurring sugar in milk, fructose, the natural fruit sugar, fructans and galactans, which are indigestible fibers found in wheat, rye, legumes, and the polyols, which include the sugar alcohol sweeteners, sorbitol, xylitol, mannitol, and isomalt, that are found in sugar-free candies and mints. Polyols are also found interesting in some stone fruits like cherries and peaches. Now, what's interesting, Tricia, is not normal to absorb FODMAPs very well. Undigested FODMAPs actually pass through the digestive tract and reach the colon where they're rapidly fermented by bacteria, and as a result you get a lot of gas and short-chain fatty acids, which typically cause the bloating and gas, cramping, and diarrhea. So in order to figure out whether these FODMAPs are actually causing your symptoms, you need to avoid all types of these FODMAP foods for 6 to 8 weeks, and then you can add back individual FODMAP groups into your diet one category at a time to see if symptoms return. And many people can manage to eat small amounts of these problem foods once they've been stabilized. So we don't have time to go into the details of the diet, but if people want more information on the IBS dietary strategies, including this, there's a dietitian by the name of Kate Scarlatta, and she has a book called Eating Well for IBS and a blog that goes into great detail about the FODMAPs, and that is Kate Scarlatta, scarlata.com. And there's another book written by dietitian Patsy Katsos called IBS Free at Last, and her website is ibsfree.net. And both Kate and Patsy have some really good information about FODMAPs. And finally, the last thing I just wanted to mention, this is a long answer, but the diet is a key component of this, is there certainly have been several studies that have demonstrated positive therapeutic gains with the probiotics in IBS. We've seen a reduction in bloating and gas as a result of certain probiotics. Seems to be a consistent finding in some published studies. And some strains have also significantly reduced abdominal pain. So there are lots of strategies that people can use for IBS.
Wow, that was great, and that sounds really interesting. I'll have to check out that site. And for anyone that didn't get all the notes on that one, we will be giving a transcript, so you can have that as a follow-up. So, Daniel, then, we had a lot of questions from people saying, I'm following the gluten-free diet, but I'm still having symptoms. What else might be going on? I know that seems sort of broad, but we don't want to get into, you know, specific diagnosis here, but what happens when you get case studies like this? What kinds of typical things might be obvious culprits for these kinds of problems?
Great question, and that was actually one of our early and in some ways more important lines of research that we did at the Celiac Center, looking at just this problem, because it's very, very common. Overall, you know, in patients with celiac disease, probably 30% of people will come in with just that complaint, so it's very common. And what we've actually found is the most common reason for people to have persistent or recurrent symptoms, in celiac disease at least, is that actually some gluten is still sneaking into the diet. And this can happen through a variety of ways that are just very difficult for people to pinpoint. If it's in a medication, a new medication, or even old medication that's switched manufacturers, it's in a grain that should be naturally gluten-free, such as soy, but is contaminated somewhere along the processing. So that's probably the single biggest reason why people with celiac disease have continued to recurrent symptoms. Beyond that, however, there's a number of other disorders that can coexist with celiac disease, including lactose intolerance, fructose intolerance, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which it can be tested for with a simple breath test, or less commonly things like microscopic colitis, inflammatory bowel disease. So there's really a long list, but I think the most important thing to realize is that most of them are harmless. A lot of people get very worried when they have recurrent symptoms that they have refractory celiac disease or something like that, and thankfully that's quite uncommon. And really just checking in with your dietitian, again, these are diagnoses that where the core treatment is dietary. And following the gluten-free diet, as I think most people are beginning to be aware, is really no easy feat, even for the most motivated, educated patients. So really checking in with your dietitian and going over things one more time, just to make sure there's no new areas where gluten might be sneaking in, is really the first step in this for this issue.
Shelley, anything you want to add to that?
Well, of course, you know I always want to add more. Dan is right. For my practice, I certainly see that it is the gluten getting into the diet. To learn where all the possible sources of gluten is pretty challenging, especially when you first start out on the diet. And as Dan mentioned, it could be in your supplements or medications, but it's often in foods that people are not aware of. They might be using soy sauce, not realizing that soy sauce may be a combination of soy and wheat. Some of your salad dressings and seasoning blends and processed meats like ham and hot dogs. I just found a brand of ham the other day and noticed when I was reading the ingredients it had wheat starch in the glaze, and often it's cornstarch, but in this particular brand it was wheat starch. A lot of your imitation seafood and some flavored coffees and herbal teas, chocolates, licorice, malt vinegar, these are just some of the things that people may not be aware of. So they need to really work with the dietitian and go through the diet with a fine-tooth comb. The other area is that they might be aware but not realizing they're getting contamination either at home or when they eat out. So a few tips that I give people is to make sure that you have separate containers for items like your butter and margarine and peanut butter and jam that you label gluten-free and put in a separate area of the fridge or cupboard so that your family members or roommates who are eating gluten-containing products don't come in and do the double dip and cross-contaminate by them dipping into your butter and buttering their bread and then going back again. So that's another reason why I recommend people buying squeeze bottles of condiments like ketchup and mustard and relish and mayo. Another thing is people don't realize you need to have a separate toaster because there's cross-contamination. So if you can't have a separate toaster, you could at least get a toaster oven where you can remove and wash the rack. There's another thing that's kind of neat is you can now get these little reusable toaster bags where you can put your gluten-free bread in and use it in a regular toaster. I also recommend that people store all their gluten-free flours and dry goods in a separate cupboard, and if that's not possible, at least on the top of the pantry shelf over the gluten-containing products, because if you do it the other way around, when people are going to open those up, crumbs and flour dust can be falling onto the packages of the gluten-free items. And the other one that I think, Dan, you probably agree, is that eating out is probably one of the biggest challenges where people are getting, you know, the hidden gluten, is because we could talk all night about that. But I think a few tips certainly is you want to call the restaurant the day before you go or earlier in the day and ask to speak to somebody knowledgeable, such as the chef or manager, to see what kind of options they have. Can they substitute ingredients or create an alternative menu item? And many restaurants now have gluten-free menus, but that doesn't mean that it's, you know, you're looked after. You still have to, when you get to the restaurant, convey to your server and the chef or manager that you need that strict gluten-free diet, and you've got to ask a lot of questions about how things are prepared and ingredients used and how they serve it. So if our listeners are looking for some more ideas on how to help you with eating out, there's a really good resource at the website www.glutenfreepassport.com. Lots of good ideas on how to learn to eat out safely.
That was great. Thank you. And I know that we do want to support the various resources, and I know there's a lot of good sites out there. And, of course, Dan's book and Shelley's book, which are very different in what they offer up, are great resources. Any others, Dan, that you often say to your patients are great places that they should go for information?
Yeah, you know, as you mentioned, there are a lot of great resources out there. And these days, you know, finding people's local celiac support groups is often very helpful, especially in doing things like picking restaurants that are around you that are known to be friendly and knowledgeable about the gluten-free diet. The National Foundation for Celiac Awareness, of course, is a great site, celiaccentral.org. The National Institute of Health has a website which has some good information. The other major celiac organizations, the Celiac Sprue Association, the Celiac Disease Foundation, all have good sites. We also have one of our own that will be that is just beginning beta testing and will be out, called Celiac Now, which is really devoted covering much of the same stuff that's in our book, and teaching the gluten-free diet on sort of a basic level in a way that really isn't out there right now. So I think there's a growing number of really great internet sources out there.
And, of course, the Internet is why we're all here today, which is certainly people are using it. And I know that we had a lot of support from our bloggers that are interested in the disease conditions and the various websites that you mentioned. Now to sort of the heart of the matter. Dan, there's a baffling selection of probiotic foods and supplements crowding the shelves in the health food and grocery stores. We're seeing lots of advertising about probiotics these days. It seemed to be sort of one of the hot topics for 2011. Now we're into 2012. What are probiotics? How do they work with regard to, I guess, the gut and our health?
Sure. So I think, you know, the thing, just to give some background, is really to realize that the gut is the main way, by far, that our immune system interacts with the environment. I mean, people often think, you know, of things like the skin, but really the skin's job is actually to prevent your immune system from having to deal with the environment. It's fairly inert. But really, almost, you know, by and large, the lungs play sort of a distant second, but the GI tract is the way our immune system learns about the environment we're in and responds to it. And because of that, being able to modulate what's in your gut, what sort of stimulates or calms your immune system, can really have effects throughout your entire body. And that's the sort of founding theory behind probiotics. So probiotics are live microorganisms. These are, you know, friendly bacteria, yeasts, and other things that, in theory, we can add to the intestine to change the makeup of the bacteria and other organisms that live in our intestine, predominantly in the colon, but to some extent in the small intestine as well. And by modulating these, we can have effects on gastrointestinal symptoms, gastrointestinal diseases, and also potentially diseases, you know, far outside of the gastrointestinal tract, everything from inflammatory arthritis to obesity and the like. So we are, you know, this is an area that really is just beginning. As before I get on, I would separate out probiotics from something that is often mistaken, is prebiotics. Prebiotics are actually sort of foods that you can eat or nutrients that stimulate the growth of very similar types of populations of bacteria. It's sort of one step removed from probiotics. You're giving the fertilizer, so to speak, for the bacteria that you really want to grow in your intestine. And they come in many, many different forms. Again, there's tens of thousands of types of microorganisms living in our intestinal tract at any one time. Figuring out which of these are useful as probiotics, which of these we really want to take in and can have meaningful effects on how people feel and on disease states, is really only just beginning. There's a handful that have been studied. To some extent, these include Lactobacillus, Bifidobacter, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, are probably some of the most common. There's a variety of other ones out there. But really, you know, it is very difficult to give people good recommendations on which probiotic to take for which disorder, how much they need to take, and when they should take, when they should expect to see improvement or not. You know, we're really just scratching the surface of probiotics in health and disease. I would say in general, though, that the great thing about probiotics is that they are, by and large, very, very safe. So this is one of the reasons that many of us feel comfortable going to probiotics, even when, you know, it's not entirely clear, should we be looking at a Saccharomyces probiotic? Should we be looking at a Lactobacillus probiotic? Should we have a combination? Would that be better? Really outside of people who are severely immunosuppressed or have severe acute pancreatitis, those are pretty much the only cases where probiotics are a potential hazard. And in everyone else, it's really, these are things that can be very helpful, but it's there is some trial and error involved, and often, you know, you try one based on your clinical experience or anything that's been published in the literature. But I do tell people not to give up with just one probiotic because there's a number of different combinations. You know, go to as long as they're from reputable companies, there's nothing wrong with trying a number of them to see which one really works best in your system.
So then it's safe to use them, I've heard you say. If you're a celiac patient or IBS, it's safe to use them. And what kinds of positive outcomes have you experienced or seen in your research? I know that in, you know, chapter 41 in your book, you start with Kathy, a 19-year-old female, and you give a little case there, and you spend some time discussing and have a little table about the probiotics and health benefits. And those are also on the JamesonDirect.com website under probiotics. But so IBS, celiac disease, it's a comfortable place for you to work?
Yeah, quite so. And I think, you know, for me, the ideal candidate for probiotic therapy is someone in whom, you know, if they have celiac disease, in whom they're on a good gluten-free diet, their blood tests, their celiac blood tests have normalized, we don't think there's ongoing intestinal damage, but yet they're still having some lingering symptoms, things of like bloating, alternating diarrhea and constipation, symptoms that in general have some overlap with irritable bowel syndrome. And again, irritable bowel syndrome coexists with it, with all other GI disorders. It's not a, these aren't a diagnosis of exclusion. People can have more than one. And in those cases with just those lingering, really kind of annoying symptoms, you know, a probiotic can really make a big difference in just taking people from I'm feeling better, but I'm not doing where I'm not where I really want to be, to feeling really back to normal again. And I think us and a lot of other people are now using this very frequently in that exact scenario.
And so, in the case of when a patient comes in and that's something that you discuss with them, is this a 15-day, 30-day, 90? Like, you know, you don't just try it for a week. How do you kind of give them a timeline?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I typically say that you should be noticing some difference within 2 to 3 weeks. If at a month you really don't feel any different, then it's time to switch to a different probiotic. If on the other hand, if at a month you're making some progress but you're not, say, fully back to where you want to be, then you just give it more time. But you really, within a month, you should be seeing some believable, consistent improvement, or else it's just time to try a different avenue.
Okay. And then, Shelley, there were lots of questions that came in, and one certainly that comes up a lot again, and as a dietitian you'd meet, is probiotics. You know, we see them all in yogurt and cheese and all sorts of ice cream or all sorts of different foods. When we get a probiotic from food or from pills, what's the difference, or one better than the other?
Well, those are interesting questions, and there's certainly no black and white answers because there's so many factors involved, which we don't have time to go into tonight, but certainly listening to this webinar all day from the top experts around the world on probiotics, and I also wanted to see what answers I got. I had, you know, from my research and what I know about them. and they did concur that, you know, that there's no one right answer, but a few things, as you mentioned, that there's a real array of probiotics that you can find in the yogurts and the fermented drinks and cheese, and now they're adding it to so many other foods, from cereals to juice to baked goods and snack bars. But you can also get the probiotics as the supplements that come in many different forms, your powders and capsules and tablets. Now, when we're discussing whether you want to do a food or a supplement, one advantage of the food sources of probiotics is that they do contain a variety of other nutrients in addition to the probiotics. But here's where it gets interesting, and listening to this several sessions today, is that you may not always be getting the therapeutic dose that's beneficial. Sometimes you can, sometimes you may not. It just depends, because there's a real problem and a challenge with formulation that it can affect whether the probiotics remain viable during the food processing and for shelf life of the product. And interesting listening to one of the speakers today talking about the type of food, whether, you know, for example, yogurts and yogurt drinks, you can use a wide variety of different strains that can remain viable, whereas in some other heat-treated foods, you have to use certain strains that are encapsulated, or they have to be spore-like. So it gets quite complicated when it comes to the food. Now, when you go to the supplements, it certainly can be more convenient, and you can get a higher level of the probiotics that can survive the passage through your acidic contents of the stomach and delivered to the intestinal tract, where they exert their beneficial effects. So I think the bottom line is, whether you get probiotics from food or pills, they can be both effective. But the important consideration is that you're getting a high enough number of the specific strain or combinations of strains that have been tested in the research studies for efficacy and works in very specific conditions. So the dosage of a probiotic strain, when you look at it, is measured in something that we call CFUs, which stands for colony-forming units. Now, this is the indication of the number of live microorganisms that are present in your food or supplement. And on average, doses may range from, to get the beneficial effects, can be anywhere in the above the 100 million CFUs per day. And to be effective, that recommended dosage has got to contain the same number of CFUs that was shown in the research study. And if you look at a lot of the research studies, there has been documented health benefits ranging from 50 million to more than a trillion CFUs per day, depending on the strains and the conditions that are being treated. So I think another key point that about the ingestion of probiotics is that it doesn't lead to long-term colonization and survival in the gastrointestinal tract. They're transient microorganisms, so you've got to maintain that colonization, and the only way you can do that is by taking them regularly. And most published studies have used daily consumption, and in some cases multiple times per day, that are recommended. And one other thing that people need to look at is, when you're reading the label, it's important that the probiotics that you're buying are guaranteed the potency right through the end of the product shelf life, because some manufacturers are just claiming potency at the time of manufacturing as opposed to the time of expiry. So maybe by the time you consume it, there's nothing left in the product. So this webinar that we listened to today from Europe certainly showed us that we have so much more to learn about probiotics and the roles that they play in general health and various disease management, but it's extremely exciting to see the emerging research and products and recommendations that are evolving. So I guess the bottom line is that you've got to keep reading and stay tuned, because we have a lot more to learn.
But just a little bit more, one of the consumers that wrote in was asking about, then, are the brands on shelf as efficient as the brands kept in the refrigerator? Dan, is there a difference?
So it's really very dependent on the type of microorganism in the combination and the manufacturing process. Some of them, especially things like Saccharomyces cerevisiae, that's sort of related to brewer's yeast, and we know, you know, anyone who cooks and bakes knows you can keep that stuff on the shelf in the kitchen for years, and then when you use it still works. Other things are much less tolerant of that sort of keeping. So, there, you know, again, in many ways, there is no hard and fast rule that you can apply across the spectrum of probiotics. And that's why I really try to focus on telling people, you know, you really have to go with a reputable brand, a reputable manufacturer, because that's, you know, really you're relying on their word that they're producing things in a way that's going to be viable at the time when you take them. I think at the moment, until there comes a time when there may be some sort of labeling or standardized testing of probiotics, that's sort of the best we can do on that front.
Yeah, I was just going to jump in, Tricia, because, you know, they discussed about the, you know, you can encapsulate these, some of these probiotics so that they will get past the gastrointestinal tract and get and be released into the to the lower gastrointestinal tract to do their job. And some of them are heat stable enough, but there's it's quite an art and a science to develop it. And as I mentioned, there's now some a category of the there's the we know about the lactobacillus and the bifidobacterium, but these bacillus probiotics are spore-forming probiotics, so they can survive against heat and pressure and food processing and survive the digestion without needing to be encapsulated. So it's quite, from listening to it again today, it's quite an art and a science to get the probiotics to get through to the system where you want them to. But from what we see over the past years, they've made great strides in doing that.
And then, Dan, how about can you take too high a dose? And can you take them for an unlimited amount of time, for example, your lifetime, was another question that we had.
So, yeah, I mean, as I said, that you know, there's very, very little toxicity with this. I mean, I have seen people who went a little bit overboard and caused themselves a little bit more gastrointestinal symptoms. And oftentimes, you know, you may even consider having people sort of ramp up, not take the full recommended dose on the first day they're trying a probiotic. You just never know how people are going to react. But often starting at a low dose and working up to that recommended amount makes some sense. And certainly if you go beyond the recommended amount, you could develop some gastrointestinal symptoms, but they'll be very transient, and once you go back down, they'll fade away. But there, other than that, you know, there really is no sort of toxicity. There's no sort of overdose risk or no chance of harmful effects building up over time. Again, for the most part, these are things that already live in our intestinal tract to some extent. We're just sort of trying to change the proportions around a little bit by doing so, by taking probiotics.
And then, Dan, to you as well, there was one question again from our consumer asking, are stool samples reliable in evaluating probiotic populations in the gut?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question. And you know, it's actually quite a difficult thing to figure out what is actually living in your intestine, either in especially in proportions, because again, that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about whether or not you have Saccharomyces or lactobacillus in your intestine, because you do. It's just a question of how much you have and how much you have compared to some of the things you don't necessarily want so much of. And that type of quantitative analysis of what's actually living in your intestine is very, very difficult. Even on, you know, by the best research labs that study this, this is no easy thing to do. The technology to do this is still evolving, and I do hope that one day in the not too distant future, this is something that would be clinically available. But at the time being, the really clinically, there's no useful way to measure what's living in your intestine, and really to guide therapy based on that.
And then Shelley. We had another consumer ask about vitamins and minerals, and do people with IBS or celiac patients need to take vitamin supplements, and what would be any nutrition concerns or deficiencies that they might have?
Yeah, that's a good question, Tricia. Where do I start? Well, why don't I split it up, you know, do celiac disease, gluten sensitivity, and IBS. For people with newly diagnosed celiac disease, they've certainly got a lot of nutritional concerns, depending on how long they've had the disease before they got diagnosed, the degree of small intestinal damage, and whether they've got any other associated health conditions. So the thing we start out with first is always getting them on the gluten-free diet, because once the villi begin to heal, you can absorb a lot of the vitamin minerals. So taking a lot of vitamins and mineral supplements at the beginning, you're just going to probably waste it. It's just going to go at the other end. And one of the common problems we see in people with newly diagnosed celiac disease is anemia. In the research study that I was involved with, what we called the Canadian Celiac Health Survey of over 2,600 adults, we found that 66% had anemia prior to diagnosis, and this can be due to iron, folic acid, or even B12 deficiency, although it's usually iron deficiency that's the most common. So what I encourage people to do is obviously follow the diet strictly, and then consume iron-rich foods like your lean meat and shrimp, oysters, sardines, eggs, nuts, seeds, legumes, some of the gluten-free grains like amaranth and quinoa, using even things like blackstrap molasses, dried fruits, and looking for enriched gluten-free cereals and pastas and breads. So that's one thing, is dealing with the iron. The other one is a problem is osteopenia and osteoporosis that is common in undiagnosed, untreated celiac disease. So you need to follow that strict gluten-free diet so that you can absorb that calcium and vitamin D, plus choosing calcium-rich foods like your milk and yogurt and cheese and fortified orange juice or fortified soy or almond or rice beverages, things like canned salmon and sardines with the bones, figs, kale, bok choy, and almonds are a few examples. And it's often tough to get enough vitamin D from foods because it's only added to milk and some fortified soy beverages and juice. So getting fish oil supplements or a vitamin D supplement would be important. And the other thing is that for people with celiac disease, if they started out with diarrhea, they do need to follow that strict gluten-free diet so they can heal and the diarrhea will resolve. And hopefully, and then you can start absorbing a lot of your vitamins and minerals. So those are just a couple of the nutritional things that and supplements that people need to be aware of for celiac. For gluten sensitivity, usually they present with diarrhea or constipation or both. So you would do similar dietary strategies as you would for those with celiac disease. That is, you know, following a strict gluten-free diet, getting plenty of fluids, and choosing appropriate fiber sources in adequate amounts. Now, for people with IBS, nutritional concerns really vary considerably, as I mentioned, for those, depending on whether they have diarrhea, constipation, or both. And they may have nutritional deficiencies, depending on how many foods they've been restricting. So that's why they really need to work with the dietitian. And the dietary recommendations for the fiber and supplements have to be individualized. So they may need to take some supplements. For example, if they have lactose intolerance, they may need to use lactose-reduced dairy products, or they could take the lactase enzymes when they consume the dairy products. And we talked about the FODMAPs and using the probiotics. So those are some of the little things that you would need to pay attention to from a nutritional perspective and supplements. And by that way as well, you need to be aware that if you're getting supplements, you want to find them, the ones that are obviously that are gluten-free.
Great. And then, Dan, I know these seem sometimes like maybe not earth-shattering question, is there a time of day for taking a probiotic? Is it better with food or after a meal, before? Is there anything about it like that?
There's probably not a specific time of day that's better or worse, but we do generally recommend taking them with a meal. The predominant reason for that is just so you dilute out some of the stomach acid and other enzymes that could potentially start to degrade or kill off some of the active microorganisms. So we do suggest taking them with a meal. But other than that, you know, really the goal is really just to take them regularly. So whatever works for people, and they can remember to do it on a regular basis, is going to be the best option.
And Shelley, we've got questions around, again, constipation and diverticulitis. Would probiotics help with these problems? What are some, you know, recommendations for people IBS or celiac disease around constipation? I know that comes up a lot for us in workshops.
Yes, constipation is definitely a very common problem for people with celiac disease. For people that started out with diarrhea, once they get on the gluten-free diet, they often get constipated because you're suddenly removing the wheat bran and the other high-fiber gluten-containing grains. But surprisingly, there's about a third of the celiac population that actually presents with constipation, not diarrhea. So then once they remove those high-fiber, gluten-containing sources, the constipation gets worse. So we like to encourage certainly a lot of fluids and then high-fiber, gluten-free sources, because most of the gluten-free products are made from refined flours and starches, like your white rice flour, tapioca, corn, and potato starch. So looking to incorporate more nuts and seeds, legumes and legume flours like your chickpea garbanzo flour and bean flours, adding ground flax, getting more fruits and vegetables, some of the higher fiber gluten-free grains like amaranth, buckwheat, millet, quinoa, brown and wild rice, teff, using something called mesquite flour. You can actually get the mesquite pods that you can grind up and add it to some of your gluten-free recipes, and gluten-free oats, dried fruits, and popcorn. So I always remind people if they're going to start adding fiber, and especially new ones, to the diet, that they do it gradually and gradually increase that intake, and then make sure, as I mentioned, to get enough fluids, because if you pack in all that fiber and don't add enough fluids, it'll just get worse.
Great. Thanks, Shelley, for that. And Dan, one of the respondents in our workshop wanted to know, what is the latest research on IBS? And in fact, there were some other questions around, is IBS just sort of a way to provide a diagnosis for things people don't understand in the gut? Is this really a disease condition? Those were that sort of grouping of questions around that.
Sure. So, not too long ago, I think a lot of people would have agreed with the idea that IBS was sort of just a sort of umbrella term for a bunch of things we didn't understand. But the more research that's been done on it, the more it really does appear to be a real distinct medical entity. And there are changes with nerve sensitivity. There are changes with some sort of very subtle but probably quite real inflammation, dealing with mast cells and some other types of immune cells that sort of wouldn't be typically active in celiac disease or inflammatory bowel disease or other things. So I think irritable bowel syndrome is really a real entity. Again, we don't know exactly what causes it or what triggers it, but there are real changes that appear to be fairly standard in large groups of patients in this being researched. So I think this is really going to lead to new understandings, new potential therapies for irritable bowel syndrome in the near future. So it's an interesting time for that condition.
I know one that comes up a lot, Dan and Shelley, is around you've gone and eliminated gluten from your diet, and then you want to be tested to see if you do have celiac disease or just gluten sensitivity. So what is the, do they have to introduce it back? What should they do? How does that process work?
Sure. So, the great thing in many ways about celiac disease is that everything that we can test should normalize after some time on a gluten-free diet. That includes intestinal biopsy, blood tests, patient symptoms. So there's really no medical test we have that can differentiate a person without celiac disease from a person with celiac disease who's doing a good job on the gluten-free diet. So that, in general, is a great thing. The problem is, though, that if people are already on a gluten-free diet before they get tested, it makes it very difficult to figure out if they do or do not have celiac disease. There's a number of ways you can handle this, but the classic way, and then still the most common and probably single best way to figure it out, is really to have them introduce gluten back into the diet in a controlled way, so that we can see if the classic signs and symptoms of celiac disease, the blood tests, and finally the intestinal biopsy, the damage to the small intestine mucosa, are triggered by gluten exposure. How much gluten and for how long is actually not well defined. The classic gluten challenge that's been done for 50, 60 years basically had people go back on a regular diet, which is at least 2 servings of gluten-containing products, a minimum of 4 slices of bread per day, for 8 weeks before repeat testing was done. That's obviously a lot to ask of someone who is on a gluten-free diet because they found that gluten makes them feel unwell. We are learning now in some of our research and others that this is probably unnecessarily long and more gluten than people need to ingest for the vast majority of people. In some research that we've been recently doing, we found that, up to 85-90% of people can actually be diagnosed with just a 2-week gluten challenge, taking just 2.5 or 3 grams of gluten, 2 slices of bread per day. It's still not nothing. It's still something that should be done under the supervision of a physician. But it does lower the barrier significantly for evaluation of celiac disease. But this is really the reason why we really try to recommend anyone who's thinking about going on a gluten-free diet at least get the blood testing for celiac disease first. Again, if the blood testing is negative, then the chances they have celiac disease are very low, and they can go on a gluten-free diet with some confidence. And if it's positive, obviously, then you follow up and you make the diagnosis one way or the other. But it's much easier to do this before changing your diet than it is afterwards.
Shelley, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I want to just say amen to that one, too, because I probably get 1 to 2 calls a week, or emails from dietitians or patients saying, you know, I've gone on the gluten-free diet now for the last 2 to 3 months and I feel so much better, but I want to get tested. So I'm constantly, whenever I do media interviews or talk to anybody, is preaching, don't jump on the gluten-free diet bandwagon until you get tested, because as Dan mentioned, it is challenging. And for some people, like Dan mentioned, it may take only a couple slices of bread for a couple weeks, but I know I've heard other gastroenterologists and in other scenarios where in cases some people may have to be 3-4 months before the test will trip positive with a significant amount of gluten, and most people can't hack it, because if it is celiac disease, just having a few crumbs of bread for some people will make them sick, and they just won't be able to go through the challenge. Dan, I just was going to ask if you wanted to chime in too about, we do know there are cases of people that I get this quite frequently too, is that they go to get their blood test done and the TTG is negative, but we know that there's a percentage of people where they have either an IgA deficiency or maybe it's early celiac disease and the test is not 100%. So can you just concur on that or follow up on that?
Yeah, no, that's quite true. I mean, the TTG in our modern celiac blood tests are really fantastic. They're about as good as you can get for any similar type disease, but they're not perfect. They're just blood tests. The disease is defined by intestinal damage, and probably 5% of patients with celiac disease will never have a positive TTG. There's a variety of reasons for that, and one of the big ones is IgA deficiency. IgA deficiency is the most common immunodeficiency in the general population. It doesn't usually have much, if any, clinical symptoms, so people won't know they have IgA deficiency. And is one of the reasons that very often we will check a total IgA level at the same time as a TTG, just to rule that out. It's about 1 in 500 in the general population has IgA deficiency, but it's actually enriched in people with celiac disease. It's probably 1 in 50 to 1 in 100. So again, 1 to 2% of people with celiac disease will have IgA deficiency, and because they don't make IgA, they'll never have an IgA TTG blood test that's positive. So there are other blood tests that we can now use. Deaminated gliadin peptide, or DGP, can be done, and that has an IgG test that's quite good, or a composite IgA IgG test, which can also be done in those situations. But really, you know, part of it is just assessing how much risk the patient's actually at for celiac disease. And the things that really put you at high risk are having a family history of celiac disease. That's probably the big one. It's about 10% in first-degree relatives and 4 to 5% in second-degree relatives. Or if it's somebody who has a strong history of other autoimmune diseases, they have thyroid disease, type 1 diabetes. These are people that are at high enough risk that if they have gastrointestinal symptoms, even in light of a negative TTG, you may actually want to go on and do an endoscopy to look at their gastrointestinal mucosa before they go on a gluten-free diet. Again, that's a sort of a case-by-case decision, but it certainly is. Again, I think Shelley and I deal with this enough that it really is worth thinking about ahead of time rather than sort of not doing that work up front and then trying to backtrack later.
Dan, do you want to just comment about using the HLA DQ2 and DQ8 as another something that we can use for seeing to rule out celiac?
Sure, that's a great point. So genetic testing for celiac disease is something that's done increasingly commonly. Celiac genetic testing is a little different than genetic testing for almost any other disorder in that it's not a rule-in, it's really a rule-out. So you basically, in almost all cases, you need to carry the genes HLA-DQ2 or HLA-DQ8 to have celiac disease. If you don't have these genes, you basically can't get celiac disease. So that means if you test for these genes and you're negative, you know you're off the hook whether or not you're on the gluten-free diet. Again, these are genes. You're born with them. They never change. The rub is that about 30 to 40% of the general population carry these genes. So if you have a positive test for these genes, it really doesn't help you. It only helps if they're negative. And, you know, again, if somebody's on a gluten-free diet and they're unwilling to do a gluten challenge, or if somebody's at high risk due to family history and they want to see whether they really need to keep an eye on celiac disease for the rest of their lives, HLA testing can be a very, very useful strategy.
Great. Now, we've had quite a few people also ask us about children and probiotics. Dan, any position on that?
No, you know, I think, again, probiotics are safe enough that there really are no restrictions. And actually, one of the main places they're used are actually for premature infants. to prevent necrotizing enterocolitis. So there are no age restrictions regarding probiotics. You know, the doses, the amount may change, obviously, if you're dealing with a much smaller person. But that being said, by and large, the same indications for probiotics apply to adults and children alike.
Great. And then we had quite a few questions around lactose, celiac disease, lactose, as well as probiotics. So, you know, someone asked, can I get a probiotic without the dairy component? So maybe, Shelley, you can talk about, you know, the lactose and celiac disease. Maybe, Dan, you can answer the question about the probiotic and the dairy component, maybe.
Sure. You know, it's hard to say. Some of the estimates from clinical practice, we may see that 30 or 40% of people with celiac disease, especially if they've got a lot of diarrhea, may have a secondary lactose intolerance. And the reason being is in the tips of your villi are the lactase enzyme that is used to digest the lactose, which is the normal sugar, the natural sugar in milk. And it may be that people have a temporary lactose intolerance. While those villi are healing, they have to reduce their lactose in their diet. And there's several ways of dealing with that. You can buy the lactose reduced dairy products, the milk, and other products where they've already added the lactase enzyme to that dairy product, so you can have it and be able to digest it naturally. You can also buy the tablets and capsules that you can chew or take to digest the milk products when you have milk or cheese. And the nice thing about yogurt is the bacterial culture in the yogurt is already working on that lactose and converting it to lactic acid. So most people do quite well on the yogurts with the live and active cultures. Where you have to watch out is you might have to watch with things like ice cream and fluid milk if it isn't been pre-treated. But usually once a person has followed, what I start my patients out with is starting a strict gluten-free diet first. And if they're still having a lot of abdominal pain and bloating and gas and diarrhea, then we might look at a temporary lactose-reduced diet. And usually people can go back onto lactose-containing foods once the villi begin to heal. However, as you know, Dan, that really varies. Some people it can begin quite quickly, but for some people if they've had the disease for a long time, especially if they're older and have a lot of damage, it can take up to 1 or 2 years for the gut to heal. And in some cases, some people never completely heal. So I don't know, Dan, did you want to add anything there?
Yeah, no, unfortunately, I think even that is probably optimistic. In recent studies from the Mayo Group, it showed that at 2 years, about two-thirds of people still had some damage in their intestine, and at 5 years, even a third of people still had intestinal damage. I would say that the good thing about lactose intolerance is it's fairly easy for people to figure out. There are lactose breath tests and the like, but I think they're almost never really necessary. And I think, if there's any doubt, even a couple days off lactose and people can usually sort out whether or not that's a component. But I agree, especially early on, it can be common. But again, I don't think there's a need to routinely restrict lactose, because again, it's a really great nutritious food source for people who are already beginning to restrict their diet, and I like to keep the diet as diverse as possible.
Well, and the other issue, too, is because of the higher incidence of early bone disease and even osteoporosis, when you remove those dairy products, you're removing an excellent source of calcium and vitamin D. So that's why I think people I've seen over the years, they've been still following a lactose-free diet, and they've had, they're well controlled with their celiac disease 3, 4, 5 years later, and then they're having bone issues. So I think it's important for people to realize that you don't need to necessarily remove the dairy.
I agree. And as for the question about getting a lactose or dairy-free probiotic, there are probiotics out there that have lactose as a filler and those that don't. In general, that's going to be a small enough amount that unless you're talking about something different like a milk protein allergy, a casein allergy or something like that, you really don't need to worry about the amount of lactose that would be contained in a supplement or a medication.
Well, it's that bewitching hour. It is 8:59. I want to thank both of you. This has been really informative. As you know, we had well over 1,000 questions, so we certainly couldn't get through all of them. But I will offer up to everyone that we will be reviewing all the questions and posting them on the jamesondirect.com/probiotics site. We also will be doing biweekly newsletters, and we will endeavor to answer some of these questions and get them out to people. We will be sending out a copy of the transcript and the audio link for this workshop tonight. If you have any further questions, feel free to write me directly at the Jamis at teleseminar, jamesondirect.com, and I will review everything and collate again. Dan and Shelley, thank you so much, Jamison Direct, for being our terrific sponsor, and as well the NFCA for their support in getting all these wonderful resources and people together, and the bloggers that helped get the message out. One last thing I would like to do before I close is that we did promise people, 10 winners, copies of Dan and Shelley's book and a 2-month supply of Jamison Probiotics. So we will be writing everyone, but we do have Sherry Smith, Don Pettit, Kathy Agos, Diane Williams, Cheryl Walfler, Susie Steele, Estella Limo, Joan Terry, Judith Tim, and Mary Marshall have all been selected randomly from our database, and they will all be receiving these wonderful gifts and as a token of appreciation for their support and participation sending in questions. Dan and Shelley, anything else you want to say by closing?
Sure. I just want to say that if people want to get more information about the gluten-free diet, what I've tried to do on my website, which is glutenfreediet.ca, is put out the latest studies and articles and links and resources. And I have some good free resources and handouts for patients as well as dietitians and physicians. So if they go to glutenfreediet.ca, they can get those. And I have a monthly newsletter where I'm sharing the latest information, and I'm going to be sharing a lot more about the probiotics from these webinars today and some links to that. So if people are interested, they can go to glutenfreediet.ca.
And I would just close with that, you know, to continue to be aggressive with testing and looking for celiac disease because it's out there. And for people who have been diagnosed, that there's so much exciting, important research going on, to be in touch with your local academic center, to look online and see if there's any studies that you might be interested in being a part of. Because this is a time when even a small amount of effort can make a really big difference.
That's great. Thank you, you too. And I wish everyone a wonderful evening. And we will be following up with the materials as promised. And this was great and very informative. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.